one step in this long progress. It's been a team effort by us all the way. We're but part of the whole team that's worked so hard.
The shuttle era will come to an end, but they won't stop inspiring, and they won't stop being a part of the fabric of America.
We choose to go to the moon.
Good evening, everyone. This is Larry Herron, and this is also episode 1605 of Talking Space. Today is Saturday, March 30th, 2024, and as usual, we have a ton of stuff to talk about and some worked up people talking about it. So let's get right to it. So joining me tonight, we have Gene Mikulka. Good evening, Gene.
Yeah, Larry, how you doing? We're proverbially drinking from the other fire hose again, and there's another little story I want to talk about, and boy, I can't wait to get to it.
I'll bet. Also joining us is Mark Ratterman. Hi there, Mark.
And I'm sure everyone's looking forward to the introduction of a new device on Talking Space. It's called the Frappomatic, and you'll know when we've got it turned on.
Excellent. Also, should mention Dr. Kat Robison and Sawyer Rosenstein are out this time, but they will be back. And tonight, I'm going to start off by mentioning that I went to the CRS 30 launch back on March 21st, and that was a day launch. It was a sunny and quite windy day with nary a cloud in the sky. And I am a newcomer to daytime Falcon 9 launches. That was my first one. Was lucky enough to see it from the NASA press site. And so daytime launches to me, seem like quite a different animal. Seems like it's a little less spectacular somehow than a night launch. I compare it to the IM-1 launch that was also a Falcon 9 that I saw, you know, back when that one took off. And I tended to concentrate more on what I could hear than what I could see, because daylight obscures a lot, where you have, you know, glow from rocket exhaust at night that cues your eye exactly where to go. It wasn't the same during the day. The booster return to landing site was not as visible, you know, because again, at night you got the rocket engine exhaust to guide you to where to look. But the other half of that was at the press sites closer to the SpaceX landing zones for the booster. So I perceived the double sonic boom to be louder at the press site than it was at the Saturn V center viewing area for the IM-1 launch. I just wanted to throw that in there just to, you know, give a little perspective from a Falcon 9 launch newbie. Now I have one of each, a night launch and a day launch, and extremely different animals, in my opinion. Any input on that, guys?
Well, tell us about the booster landing.
The booster landing got the double sonic boom, although I didn't, even though I knew where to expect it to be, I still couldn't quite spy it, except for a very brief interval where the second of the three burns was going off. But by the time I figured out where the booster had landed, it had already landed, and I could tell just by the exhaust smoke and, you know, dirt that got stirred up on the landing zone after it had actually touched down. So that's what I recall about it.
Well, I'll share, which I've done this before, but just I'll quickly talk about STS-133 Discovery's landing. It was a daytime landing, and I was on the property for it. However, I was just late enough to have missed transportation to the shuttle landing facility. And so Ouch. I'm at the press site, and there's a scattering of people outside, and, you know, we're listening to the announcement of, you know, NASA Mission Control talking about, you know, it's at this phase in its landing procedures, and I see people looking up and pointing, and I look and I look and I look. Never saw Discovery. And the next two landings were at night, which didn't see them either until the shuttle rolled out in front of the bleachers at the shuttle landing facility, which, you know, everything lit up. I did see the shuttle on those two night landings, but never saw Discovery during the day. And it was interesting to get the sonic boom, which was picked up by microphones at the landing facility, and you could hear it in the loudspeakers. And I thought, well, that wasn't all that loud. And then the appropriate number of seconds for the distance between the two locations transpired, and boom, there it was, right where I was at. It's like, oh, that's a good explanation of the speed of sound.
Yeah.
So it's fun.
Very good. Yeah, there's nothing like being there in person. I have to say, you can watch everything you want on YouTube and on TV and everything else, get all kinds of close-up camera angles and everything else, but it's nothing like the sights and sounds of being there in person.
And I should add, Mark, that was the very first time this show had credentialed access to the Kennedy Space Center for a landing event. So, and I remember you and a former member of the crew here, Gina Hurley, representing us out there. And you guys did a superb job with all of that. So thanks.
Yeah. We were there from 1:33 on, although I think we all missed the 1:33 launch because it got rescheduled so many times. I don't think any of us were on site for the actual launch.
All I do remember is the press conferences and seeing you and Gina over in the corner. And I believe, Mark, you had asked a question during a post-scrub, and I was just so darn proud. I just lost a couple of buttons on my shirt watching that. My chest was so, you know, puffed out watching you guys and seeing you guys over there. So just on a personal note and just on a show note. So you guys really, really did a bang up job in representing us out there. And I'm really looking forward to seeing more of you guys and hopefully joining you guys at a couple of these events.
Well, I don't know. My perception lately is that you're more likely to participate in a phone bridge press event. Not that I would complain, but oh well.
Yeah, we're I've already done that several times. So
what you're saying though is that you're perceiving that NASA is having fewer and fewer in-person news conferences. Is that the idea?
I would say so, and I would generalize. Gene has made a great effort to be on many phone bridge type events, but I think the people that get called on is not the ones that were, like Talking Space was called on from 1:33 on, and there in person we had recognition as to who we were, who we were with, and we would get called on. And I don't know that happens on the phone bridge business, but not that I would complain.
I will say that no, it does not. I've been on the Conga line a few times, and unfortunately, we have not been called, and kind of annoys me a little bit. But it is what it is, and I will present the data that I've accumulated at those events, and will continue to do so. But it's sad that I don't get a chance to represent my listeners and you guys out there at these things when we get a chance. So it is what it is. We'll keep moving. We'll keep plugging.
All right. So up next, remember the lawsuit that was filed by the Center for Biological Diversity against the FAA and SpaceX? You know, the one that was lodged back on May 1st of 2023 after the damage caused in and around the Boca Chica Starship launch pad and the surrounding wetlands after the first integrated flight tests back on April 20th of 2023. Well, that lawsuit we wanted to, we promised you that we'd keep you updated. So there's been not a whole lot to say about it for several months, but it's been stuck deep in a legal and procedural quagmire for the past several months now with not much progress at all. So I just thought you'd like to know, since we promised we'd keep you up to date. So it looks like even Eric Resch, who was on our show a few times, underestimated the timeline on that lawsuit. It's been almost 11 months and counting still.
And we keep watching, and I'm sure Eric will go ahead and keep us informed, too, as to what's going on. And we will also keep an eye on it. And, you know, we'll just keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully we'll hear something.
Yep. Yep. Well, should be interesting.
Indeed.
Next, we're talking about a giant leap in astronomy technology. To be unveiled on April 3rd, the world's largest digital camera for astronomy, constructed by the Department of Energy's SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory and its collaborators, is finally complete. And this camera is the size of a small car, weighs around 6,600 pounds, and its front lens is over 5 feet across. It's the largest lens ever made for this purpose. Its focal plane is so flat that its surface varies by no more than a tenth of the width of a human hair. With a resolution of about 3,200 megapixels, the pixels themselves are only 10 microns wide. So now this isn't just about size, it's about scope. So within a single image, it could cover a swath of the sky 7 times wider than the full moon, producing images so detailed that it could resolve a golf ball from 15 miles away. But what's really exciting is the camera's potential to transform our understanding of our universe and our own solar system. It'll be used to map the positions and measure the brightness of a vast number of night sky objects, helping researchers infer a wealth of information. And this camera will help us study everything from dark energy to dark matter, observe patterns in the distribution of galaxies, and spot supernova. Closer to home, it could lead to a new understanding of how our solar system formed. And also, and this is particularly interesting as I see it, help identify threats from asteroids that get a little too close to Earth, even very small ones. So stay tuned for more updates as this camera is shipped to the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile, where it will be mounted to the Simonyi Survey Telescope. This instrument was 2 decades in the making, and we can't wait to see what this technological marvel reveals about our universe.
Yeah, Lars, I was just wondering if that was going to be going to the Rubens facility or not, and I'm glad to hear that it is. It should help go ahead and augment Neo Surveyor too. That is the NASA planetary defense mission, the second one,
right?
And that too will be looking for errant asteroids that may have our name on it. If I recall exactly, NASA still has a mandate to go ahead and find all of these asteroids within a certain time frame. And I believe this is a congressional mandate. So this camera should go ahead and help with that discovery. And this is one of the other complaints, too, about some of these, you know, I can go off and on some of these constellations that are going up there, these, you know, large satellite constellations that are going up there. And this is the observations, or the observations from this camera, is something that those constellations could obscure. So I'm really hoping something, you know, I understand people need to make money, but I also understand that, you know, heck, we've, you know, scientists still need to do their work. And
right.
I'm hoping that at some point there's going to be a happy medium drawn someplace.
So up next, Gene, you have some information about an astronaut who is, I'll say, who's going back home to one of his homes.
Yeah, Larry, that's a great way of putting it, actually. with this individual, I'm talking about none other than NASA astronaut Don Pettit, who's basically returning to his home away from home, the International Space Station, on Expedition 71 and 72, he will be flying on board a Soyuz spacecraft with two Russian cosmonauts, Alexei Overtichin, who I'm butchering his last name, and I do apologize for that, and Ivan Wagner. They will be flying on Soyuz MS-26 in September of 2024. Pettit is a veteran of three other past space flights. He's made advancements in technology and demonstrations for human exploration. He's served as the science officer for Expedition 6 in 2003. He operated the robotic arm for the space shuttle Endeavour on STS-126. And I believe he also served as the flight engineer on Expedition 3031 in 2012. He's logged about 370 days in space and has had the honor of walking in space twice, totaling 13 hours, 17 minutes. Expedition 6 was kind of interesting. That particular crew launched to the International Space Station on STS-113 on board the space shuttle Endeavour, and they were expected to return on STS-114 on the space shuttle Discovery after a two-month mission or so. Unfortunately, the Columbia accident happened during that period of time, and it basically grounded the shuttle fleet. The crew had to come back on Soyuz TMA-1 after about 5.5 months on the ISS, unexpected increment due to some unfortunate and sad circumstances. But Pettit is one of those scientists that is just a national resource, if not a national treasure. And I am really, really thrilled to have that individual going to the International Space Station on my behalf to conduct more science before the ISS closes its doors permanently. He has been an incredible presence. If you ever follow him on some of the social media sites too, he posts some of the photography that he has taken during those increments, and the photography he has taken is absolutely insane. He is one of these individuals that just has a tendency to just dumb things down for the layman and makes things understandable. And he is just, I mean, he is an incredible national treasure, and I'm just so happy that he's getting his increment.
Very good. Me too. So, Mark, we go from speaking of a veteran astronaut and Don Pettit to how to become a brand new astronaut.
Yeah, I find this interesting because when I started looking at the story, You know, there have been hundreds of astronauts, but how many current astronauts do you think NASA has? We've all had time to think. How about 48? Current active NASA astronauts. So it makes sense, even though early March, we met the newest class of astronauts, graduated from their approximately two-year training program, that there's already a call out for new astronaut applications. And a news story that I thought was interesting, you don't think about this. When you read the bios of the astronaut candidates that are in training and the ones that when they graduate, you know, their background, you know, you find various civilians, people from the military. Well, here's a story from the Dothan Eagle, Dothan, Alabama paper. And it says, be all you can be an Army astronaut. And they show a picture of U.S. Army Colonel Andrew Morgan on an EVA at the space station in 2020. And lo and behold, there are, or have been, I should say, I believe it was 28. And of course, now I'm not seeing that number, but relatively small number. In the Army, typically your astronauts from the military are officers, but the Army is saying, along with officers, they will have a board to select soldiers for nomination to NASA. They'll take any active duty soldier who meets the basic requirements to require, regardless of rank or military occupational specialty. There's no impediment to a junior enlisted soldier, non-commissioned officer, or warrant officer applying to become an Army astronaut, so long as they can meet NASA and Army education and other requirements. I think that's cool because it's important to appreciate that as exclusive as we might think that some careers are, especially astronaut, that they're open to anybody. They just need the people that meet the qualifications, and the Army is looking ahead and saying, we'll take any from our cadre of soldiers that meet requirements. I like that.
That's neat. Cool. What are overall, what is the number of astronauts in this next class that that NASA's looking to fill? What's the number of slots? Any idea?
Usually when they make the selections there, Larry, it's usually only really just a handful. It's probably only going to be about 10, 15 folks that are going to eventually make the cut. So, you know, the classes are kind of small, but, and the people that apply are just, you know, I mean, they're numerous. I mean, I think, what was it? The last class, the last selection class, I think had something like 3,000 applicants to it.
Oh, more than that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You're right. Correction. I think it was double. And,
yeah, it was over 12,000.
Wow. Really?
There were 10 astronaut graduates. There were also, I believe, a couple of astronauts that were part of that class that were from other countries that are not NASA yes. astronauts, but other representing their countries.
Yeah, that's correct. I believe the UAE had two astronauts in that class.
Wow. Yeah.
The Jim Bridenstine, when he was NASA administrator, increased the requirements. I believe the requirements now are a master's degree in a science or mathematics or an engineering discipline. Before it was just a bachelor's degree in said discipline. And it's it's a little tougher to get in the core, but I'm sure the rewards are going to be great, especially given the fact that we're returning to the moon. And some of these folks on this mission in these classes will not only just go to these new commercial stations that we're going to be putting up there after the ISS unfortunately takes its nosedive to Point Nemo, but they're also going to be going to the moon on an Artemis increment. So I kind of wish folks like yours truly, who are part of the who were growing up as kids of Apollo, had the chance to try to touch the moon themselves, but it just wasn't in the cards. I'm just glad now that we are going to be touching the moon again in the not too distant future.
It looks like we're going to possibly have an army of astronauts.
I'll mention something else. There's a NASA podcast. So if you go to nasa.gov/podcasts, and if you look for Houston, we have a podcast. You'll find an episode recently where they interviewed the current class that has just started training. And it's quite interesting to hear these individuals' stories of, you know, what went through their mind in thinking about applying. And, you know, in some cases, their career getting them to, you know, where they wanted to be to apply. It's a good show.
Yep, I've listened to it before as well. Agreed. Well, guys, so now next thing we wanted to talk about was the passing of a couple of giants of the world of spaceflight. Gene?
Yeah, unfortunately, we lost two individuals that have left an indelible mark on this nation's space program. One of them is former astronaut and three-star general in the U.S. Air Force, Thomas Stafford. He was 93 years old. He had such an illustrious career going to the U.S. Naval Academy, Academy commissioned in the U.S. Air Force, flying F-86 Sabres before becoming a test pilot and applying to NASA and getting the call in 1962 to become a NASA astronaut. He flew on Gemini 6, which was the another gentleman from here in New Jersey, good old Wally Schirra. And this was the rendezvous mission with Gemini 7 with Borman and Lovell on board. They were doing the long duration Gemini flight. Both Schirra and Stafford were the ones that did the first on-orbit space rendezvous. So that was not a critical, that was an absolutely critical mission to demonstrate our ability to rendezvous. And that was an absolutely critical mark for getting to the moon. He also commanded Gemini 9 with Gene Cernan on board. Cernan, of course, did his EVA and unfortunately had some issues during that EVA. And trying to go ahead and execute the game plan for that EVA, we almost lost him. And unfortunately, Stafford had the unenviable task to decide whether or not to if something were to really, really go wrong during that EVA, and Cernan could not get back in. If you recall, his Cernan's face mask kind of got clouded, and he couldn't see what the devil he was doing. And it was quite an emergency there. And Stafford, unfortunately, had the orders, if things really looked bad, to unfortunately cut Cernan loose. And that just doesn't seem like something Stafford was going to do on that flight. But Cernan managed to get back in, and turned out that he also flew next to Stafford again during Apollo 10, which was the final dress rehearsal for the lunar surface. Its mission was to go ahead and try to see how the LEM behaved around the moon and try to find out what these mass cons were all about, these mass concentrations of magnetic fields, which have a tendency to kind of screw up your navigation when you're around the moon. And, so they took their LEM code name Snoopy right into the sphere of the moon and got within, I'm trying to remember the distance from there. I don't recall what their altitude was when they finally were able to get near the lunar surface. Stafford really wanted to try to make the first landing. And he lobbied real hard to go ahead and try to see if that crew can make that first landing. And he sat down with a whole bunch of people to try to make that point and was kind of talked off the ledge on that one, because they felt that we really wanted to find out how the LEM behaved in and around the moon, and also how the LEM disassembled around the moon, because you remember that the LEM was really two spacecraft, the descent stage and the ascent stage.
Right.
And we wanted to find out how they both behaved around the moon. And also, could the Apollo command module, in this case, it was codenamed Charlie Brown, could go ahead and dock with the LEM after a lunar landing. And that was the job of John Young, who is the command module pilot on that flight. And he was able to go ahead and demonstrate that. But Stafford, really tried to lobby hard for Apollo 10 to be it. But he understood after talking to everybody that, there are a lot of still unknowns about both of these ships, and we've got to work out those unknowns. So he eventually did, and he agreed with the flight plan as is. They went for it, and they executed it flawlessly. The LEM did have a little problem, if you recall. It kind of, after it detached from the descent stage, it kind of went into a tumble. And if it, you know, both Stafford and Cernan had to really, really think fast to go ahead and get that that limb under control. A switch apparently from, I believe it was the limb radar, was left in the wrong position during fabrication and during you know, checkout. That switch apparently made the gave the radar some inerrant instructions. And I'm trying to remember this offhand. I believe it went searching for the command module, thinking it was around, and thus the reason the LEM went tumbling. After that, he was in charge of the NASA astronaut office for a little bit, and then embarked on another mission, this one of diplomacy. He was the commander of the Apollo-Soyuz test flight, and he and Alexei Leonov, who was the commander of the Soyuz on that mission, were turned out to be, you know, really good friends at the end of it. And they both walked away from that mission with enormous respect for both individuals' flying abilities. In fact, Stafford was trying to give Leonov a compliment by saying, you know, he flies by the seam of his pants. And unfortunately, in Russian, that kind of got translated into something else. And he had to, you know, go back to Leonov and say, hey, you know, that's not what I meant. So that had to be cleared up. But it really formed a tight bond between the two. After Stafford left NASA, he really didn't leave NASA. He was still the go-to guy for a lot of things. He, if I remember exactly, even on the NASA website, it states that he served as the chairman of the Operations Oversight Committee for the very first Hubble spacecraft servicing and repair mission. So this was the mission, I guess, that was going to go ahead and, you know, bring life into Hubble after the chromatic aberration discovery that was made after, you know, the lens had they found out that the lens that was on board Hubble, well, needed glasses, and Stafford was part of that team to go ahead and make sure that mission went well. He was always the go-to guy on safety. And he was a member of the NASA ASAP, their aerospace safety board. And he was also the one that had some questions about SpaceX's ability to do the load and go that they do when you have crew on board. One of the concerns he had was that they've never done anything like that before. We've never loaded fuel onto a spacecraft and onto a rocket with the crew on board. And he felt that that was kind of not a safe thing to do. He was kind of, I don't want to say rebuked about that, but it was something that NASA had to look at in its entirety. And I believe Bill Gerstenmaier took a look at it and decided that the risks were in safety limits and that a crew could be on board when they fueled it because of the fact that they had a very, very quick emergency escape on the Dragon. And if something were to happen, they can just hit the button and off of the spacecraft they would go. And I believe if you've been watching a lot of these crew launches, the emergency escape system is activated as they're fueling for that purpose. And it was something that, again, Tom Stafford brought up, and it was probably so he's even touched the Crew Dragon program. I don't want to go ahead. He has won so many awards. I can't go through all of it because if I did, we wouldn't have any more time on this show. But this is a life that was well lived. 93 years old. I am so sad to hear that he is now part of the ages. But my God, the legacy this man has left behind, and the just the what he is able been able to accomplish and what he's contributed, not only to the U.S. space program, but to his country in general, has been amazing. And I believe there's a museum named after him in Oklahoma. And Mark, you had something else too you wanted to mention about Mr. Stafford, about General Stafford, excuse me.
Yes, from my many trips where the Federal Aviation Administration has said, hey, Mark, go to this technical school, go to our academy in Oklahoma City. And from 78 up until a few years ago, I've made many, many trips there. And at one point, they were building a new classroom type building, and us unknown or ignorant students, we got to calling it the Lego building because it kind of reminded us of Legos. Well, lo and behold, that became the Thomas P. Stafford building. And in a open area in the middle of the building is a couple of display cases where we saw some badges, a spacesuit, various things from his career as an astronaut with NASA that here and there, having time to walk around and look at things, I would look at that. And you'd look at a simple badge, especially by today's standards of security and such, and think how long ago that was. And I just want to make a general comment about many astronauts. We talk about their experience, the numbers that come from the ranks of test pilots. And you think of how wild and crazy these military test pilots would be, but that's really the opposite of what happens. They're very, they're almost scripted, I would say, when they're doing a test flight on an aircraft, and it takes a certain type of individual to do those flights and to get the information that the engineers and designers are looking for to make the improvements and to go forward with aircraft and spacecraft. But I just wanted to mention the Thomas P. Stafford, which it became an acronym, of course, the TPS, which to my little space shuttle brain became Thermal Protection Systems. And so I've got a connection to astronaut Thomas P. Stafford that I appreciate. Never met him. Certainly wish I could. Hope to see the museum that Gene referred to someday.
Makes two of us, Mark. Makes two of us.
So Gene, you wanted to mention one more giant of the space industry who left us.
Yeah, we took, unfortunately, this week we took two hits. The other one was George Abbey, who was the former director of the Johnson Space Flight Center. He passed away last Sunday, March 24th, after a bit of an illness. He was a native of Seattle, and unfortunately, he passed away again at the age of 91. And again, you know, when you think about the life this man led, it was a very, very grand life, and it was one that had left a mark on his nation's space program and also on his nation, period. To make a quote here, quote, "A true visionary, Mr. Abbey demonstrated transformational leadership as NASA Johnson's seventh career director. During his tenure, the space shuttle flew more than 25 successful missions. The joint U.S. and Russian shuttle Mir program completed, providing a far important information for the long-duration spaceflight." And this was said by Vanessa Weish, the current director of NASA Johnson. Again, he was instrumental in the Johnson's team's involvement in developing and launching the first elements of the International Space Station, which marked the beginning of a new era in space. On behalf of NASA Johnson Space Flight Center, we send our condolences to Mr. Abbey's family during this difficult time, close quote. He had a long career in human spaceflight, and it started back all the way back in 1964, and really continued just like Tom Stafford's, well past his retirement from the agency. He was the director of flight operations. He oversaw the NASA's first space shuttle astronauts and mission operations and the new shuttle program's approach and landing tests. And if you've ever read Mike Mullane's book, Riding Rockets, you'll understand the other side of how George Abbey had the astronaut office going. And apparently he loved to keep those guys guessing. And
he was the guy, right? He was the guy who would make all those decisions about who was flying when and what roles they had and all that.
That's correct. And he had a way of doing it. And also, if you read Mullane's book, he was a little intimidating at times to a lot of the astronauts. I know Mullane himself was a little unnerved by the man, but that was just simply his management style. I'm guessing. It wasn't just at NASA Johnson either. He helped support NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. from 1987 to 1993. He served key roles in human spaceflight there and on the National Space Council. And he got back to NASA Johnson in 1994 as the first deputy director, then leading the development and launching of the first space station. And then he retired from NASA in 2003, excuse me. I believe, too, in December of 2021, the Saturn V rocket display outside the NASA Johnson Space Flight Center there was named after him, that pavilion. And he also kind of instituted a little project with Longhorn bulls and cows out there. And if you ever go out to NASA Johnson, I don't know whether or not they're still there. It's been a while since I've been at JSC, but there's actually a project I might be the 4-H that is in charge of it, but they basically care and feed for these longhorns over there. And they are right there at the on site at NASA Johnson. So that's something else he kind of established. He will probably still be a presence at NASA. His the repercussions of what he was able to accomplish will echo, pretty much forever through the agency. He is one of those guys that, his management style will probably just live on through that, and it will be impacting the agency for a long time to come. So, again, we lost two giants this week. We really did.
On to the next subject, NASA's headquarters library. What is going on with that?
Yeah, this is something I saw on social media this morning. And, Mark, we had a little bit of a discussion about that before we started recording. One of the individuals I follow on social media posted this, and my heart sank, to be quite honest. It was from Richard Spencer, who was the librarian at NASA HQ, and he writes the following: "It is with great sadness that I must announce that today is the last day that the NASA headquarters library will be open to the public. NASA libraries are being reorganized and consolidated, with several libraries closing their doors and others downsizing their collections." And he writes that researchers can still contact the library, including the public. They can also contact the library and continue to send questions through email. And they give the email address as library@hq.nasa.gov. And NASA employees can also contact the library through the Live Answers portal. But he just simply writes that there has been you know, it's been a pleasure meeting thousands of families and tens of thousands of students over the past 24 years, working with students ranging from preschool to graduate students. And he says it's provided him with so many rewards, and working with NASA personnel also just greatly rewarding. And on his own personal note, he basically said he thought he had the best job in the world. In a previous position as the library at a culinary college, excuse me. But he thought that he thought he couldn't get any better than that. And he said that this time being the NASA librarian has just been amazing. I was sad because that area was such a resource, and so much information is just kept over there. And I'm just wondering what's going to survive. I know NASA Goddard has got a library over there, and I'm wondering if that is going to go ahead and be going to continue, and some of the work that was held in the HQ library will be shifted over there. I mean, the resources over there were just stemmed everything from, you know, the Keith Glennon days, who was the very first NASA administrator, on through current. I mean, people, not just the public, not just students, but policymakers wandered in and out of there. I remember seeing Dr. John Logsdon in there a few years ago. It was just such a resource, and it's just a darn shame that we're going to lose that.
Yeah, both you and Mark have some, you know, like you mentioned, personal experience with that building.
It's been a while since I was there. It was actually for a NASA social event, summer of 2010. And we were there before the event started. So we went in the library, which is right there on the first floor, open to the public. And I don't get in libraries very often. I wish I did. Especially really unique libraries like the headquarters library there. But just finding things, you know, in a browse through the stacks there, that I hate to think of not having access to. Of course, people say, oh, everything's online these days. No, not necessarily. And I'll miss it. It's been 14 years since I was there. When would I have ever gotten back? Who knows? I've only been to DC a couple times, living in Florida all my life. But it's a shame. It's a shame.
Yeah, I'm just going to interject something. And this is coming from Dr. Jonathan McDowell on X. He goes by at Planet 4589. Yet another space library down, it validates my approach of accumulating as many of my own copies of things as possible. And I am forced to agree with them. I mean, I whittled down my own library here, but mostly I tossed out a lot of my IT stuff. My astronomy and space-related stuff is still here, and I'm never letting that go because, as Mark, you pointed out, not all of it is online. Not everything is online. And there are books that I still refer to that I've had since, oh, good Lord, since the 1980s. And you can't get those books anymore. Some of them are out of print. So, and that's basically why you have a resource like, you know, the NASA HQ library and libraries in general. You know, it's regrettable when any library closes, but this one, wow, this one really hit home.
As far as I'm concerned, the loss of any library is a tragedy. Even if it's just the loss of access, you know, it means a lot. So next, Gene, before we started our show, we were talking about what we were going to talk about, and you got really worked up over this one.
Oh boy, this one really torqued me off because I'll be honest with you guys, I'm a little sick of this. To be brutally blunt,
explain what we're talking about. We're talking about the some.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting. I'm getting to that. Okay. Just, I believe it was just last week, there was a series of press events around the first launch of Starliner, which is expected to be around, I believe they're scheduling May 1st, May 2nd, somewhere around that window. They've had to push the launch back a little bit, and this is due to traffic in and around the International Space Station. And as part of that whole three press conference lineup for Starliner, the last press conference was with the crew, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore. And Butch was trying to go ahead and manage expectations for the mission. He bluntly said, "This is going to be a test flight. We expect things not to work out the way they're supposed to." But that's what test flights are all about, to go ahead and find the unknowns. Mark, you talked about test pilots earlier. This is a test pilot's mission, in plain English. It's to psych out the unknowns, psych out the bugs. And Wilmore was trying to go ahead and manage expectations for the mission. He bluntly said, "Hey, we expect things to go wrong. We expect things to kind of not work according to the plan. And when we run into that, you know, that's okay. That's what we're here for. That's what we're here to discover. So this way we can go back and fix it." And every mission that flies for the very first time has got their little hiccups here and there. I'm sure Dragon had its own hiccups when it first flew for the first time, and the crew was in charge of trying to find those little hiccups and those little things that you need to go ahead and approach and fix during the course of a mission. Well, the online board futurism.com ran the following article with the headline of, quote, "Commander of First Boeing Astronaut Mission issues a warning." And I'm like, no, he didn't. He was trying to manage expectations. He is saying, "Hey, we know things are going to go wrong, and we know we're trying to psych out all the unknowns. So, you know, things might not go right, but we know this." I'm not sure I can say who this is and who wrote this, because I know who he is. I've worked with him. But I don't know if I could go ahead and say this online. I will post the thing in the show notes so you can see who it is. All I know I'm willing to say was that it was a prominent member of the space community and a bit of an entrepreneur as well. He was, to just drop a little bit of a hint, he was one of those individuals that kind of masterminded one of these asteroid mining companies that, unfortunately, as I knew what would happen, would eventually go bust. But he writes the following, and this annoyed me no end. Quote, "Boeing Space, politically entitled aerospace cost-plus contractor led by managers and lobbyists, focus on adequacy versus cost." And then he writes the following, "SpaceX, passionate believers with a clear goal to reduce cost of opening space to humanity, focused on excellence." Urgh. I hate this stuff. And the reason, quite frankly, is, yeah, I know, Boeing has had its problems right now. Boeing aviation is an absolute disaster right now. And the press just loves playing don't pile on the rabbit when anything happens over at Boeing right now because of some of these things that have been going on. The 737 MAX is still a blasted mess, and we know that. It needs to be fixed. There are things about some of the other aircraft, and there are problems galore with, you know, QC that are happening within the company itself. This week, the current CEO of the company resigned, or will say that he is out of there at the end of the year. And he's trying to stay in there so this way the search committee could go ahead and name a new CEO. It is that much of a mess. We know this. Boeing Space is another critter. They've already had, you know, and I hate to put it this way, you know, their body cavity search done by NASA after Orbital Flight Test 1, the unpiloted test that we documented here on Talking Space after it occurred, I believe, during Christmas week. And I think that was, I want to say, I don't recall exactly the year. I think it might have been 2019. We went through everything that occurred there. We know things went wrong over there. And as a result of that, and plus NASA doing some more digging, NASA under Jim Bridenstine went ahead and, you know, declared an incident and decided to go ahead and do the same thing that they had done previously to SpaceX, I might add, after its CEO decided to go ahead and light up a doobie on the darn Joe Rogan show. They also went through the same kind of intense scrutiny as far as their QC and their, when I mean QC, I mean quality control practices and so on. And even everything ingrained about it, even the management style, everything. NASA went into that thing with a microscope and really, really made suggestions to, excuse me, I just hit my printer. I'm so agitated here. Really went into how to go ahead and really fix Boeing Space to the point where they can go ahead and get things done. And yeah, I'm not denying Starliner had its problems. It's had its issues, its stirrings, its dances, and its, you know, blank ups. But again, some of this discovery that they found on Starliner has probably helped on the Dragon side of the house. For instance, that flammable tape that they found on board Starliner, guess what? That was on Dragon 2. Maybe not to the same extent, but it was on board Dragon. So that had to be all taken out. And it was a very, very fortunate discovery. So now guess what? Not only have you made Starliner a better vehicle, but you've also made Dragon a better vehicle as a result.
Yeah, that was a supplier issue as opposed to a Boeing in particular issue.
Right. Well, you know, they were using the tape and, you know, I mean, Dragon 2 has had its faux pas as well. There were still valve problems. There was still a leaky urine system on board in one area that they had to correct that was causing corrosion inside.
No, and you gotta get back to the big picture too, you know, like why are both Boeing and SpaceX in this game, right?
You just brought me around full circle. That's the whole point of this thing. And you know something? I don't usually say this, but I am going to go ahead and give Keith Cowling a bit of a shout out here because he also posted on social media, on the platform X, the following, and gosh darn it, he echoed my thoughts on this whole thing. Why not just wish the crew well? You know, I mean, why not just go ahead and say, hey, this is a step in the right direction. This is the whole point of commercial crew. We're going to have two spacecraft that can get to the International Space Station. How cool is that? This is the culmination of what we had hoped for on this program. And to be honest with you, this whole thing just kind of set me off because gosh darn it, both teams are working hard on this thing. Both Boeing Space and SpaceX are just as passionate about space as anybody else can be. And by the way, this is not Boeing's, you know, first dance in space. I mean, grant you too, SpaceX had a bit of a jump start because I believe the cargo program that they were involved in really helped them make all of the mistakes they really needed to make in order to make a crewed vehicle work. And Boeing didn't really have that luxury to go ahead and start off with. So they had to make the mistakes as they were kind of designing the spacecraft. But the whole idea is like, hey, you know, you can't dump on the entire workforce when, as Keith had said, when maybe almost all of them are really just as passionate about spaceflight as SpaceX is, as this audience is, as, you know, myself, Larry, you, Mark, Kat, Sawyer, as we all are. And we all want to see this work. So just say, hey, Godspeed, you know, crewed test flight, go get them, Butch. Go get them, Sonny. Make this ship work and make it the ship that, you know, the United States can be really, really proud of to get to the ISS and back and just really make this whole system work. Because who knows, maybe Starliner has got a future during these commercial space station visits. There, I finally got that out. But I mean, this is, again, this really got my goat, and I was just really, really annoyed about the whole thing because I'm seeing a lot of, you know, don't pile on the rabbit in the press every time, you know, say a wheel falls off or something like that. Ah, see, a Boeing plane messed up. Well, that's maintenance. Yeah. That's not a Boeing plane, and that's bad maintenance.
All right, Gene. So now it's time to take a deep breath.
All I'm saying is just, you know, hey, go ahead and just wish the darn crew well, wish the whole program well, because again, if these guys succeed, and I've said this so many times on the show, if these guys succeed, guess what? The United States space program succeeds and humanity succeeds. So go get them, Butch. Go get them, Sonny. And yeah, go get them, Crew Dragon, too. Keep that cadence up because, gosh darn it, this whole picture is making the United States number one in space.
Well said. So on to the latest NASA Advisory Committee meeting.
Yeah, that was really, really interesting there, Larry. Science Committee of the National Advisory Council met this past Monday in a unusual one-day session, and concerns continued to be raised over several issues in the NASA science community. And incidentally, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you also may want to hear about some of this as well. Now, one of the elements that was discussed is a proposal concerning a senior mini review to determine how both the Hubble Space Telescope and the Chandra X-ray Telescope can be operated under the current constrained budget climate. Now, in 2023, the Science Mission Directorate had allocated to them about $7.791 billion. 2024's allocation was somewhere more around 7.3, and the current request for fiscal year 2025 is about $7.565 billion. So indeed, the budget, instead of getting, you know, larger, is getting smaller. And indeed, this is a challenge for the Science Mission Directorate. And as we discussed in an earlier episode, all of this is due to spending constraints that were put on by Congress on all discretionary spending. So the government won't default on monetary commitments it's already made. Now, there has been some question on which missions may actually survive. The Geospace Dynamics Constellation, or GDC mission, under the Heliophysics Division, which was to observe the impact of the sun's energy on the Earth's magnetosphere, the ionosphere, thermosphere system, that mission has been canceled already. The Planetary Science Mission Division, that mission to the planet Uranus, has been put on hold. and other missions have also suffered, but the main concern has been both the Chandra X-ray Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, an ACT member and leader of the Astrophysics Advisory Committee, Kelly Holly Brockelman, indicated that although both Chandra and Hubble are well past their prime missions, both of them are still doing amazing science, and both are oversubscribed on their availability time. The call for possible termination of the Chandra X-ray Telescope came as a huge surprise to the science community. She also noted that Chandra is complemented to the James Webb Space Telescope. The instrument is still in fairly good condition, and observations Chandra does can't be performed on the ground at all by any ground-based telescope. Also, between the two missions, Hubble enjoys a lot of sympathy in Congress and in the public due to its celebrity icon status. People know the Hubble Space Telescope. They sure don't know Chandra. And if the public doesn't know Chandra and what it's capable
of doing, that's really sad because one of the things that I have read about with Chandra is that even the telescopes, the X-ray telescopes that are being planned to replace it, won't have the same capability that Chandra has.
That's exactly right. And that was something also that Kelly Holly Brockelman was also saying. But the whole idea, too, if the public doesn't know about it, neither will congressional appropriators. And so you've got that problem there, too. So you basically have to go ahead and show Congress what Chandra is really, really capable of and what abilities are there that can't be duplicated and probably won't be duplicated if you go ahead and lose that telescope for another 10, 15, 20 years or longer. Now, she also noted that the main concern here is the what's called the Operations Paradigm Change Review, and this is basically the mini senior review process that's slated to begin soon. Now, in a regular senior review for a spaceborne device or any really science mission, the Astrophysics Advisory Committee or the APAC would have a role and would have input into that process. Now, since the APAC meetings are made public, the public too would have some sort of input as to what is going on here. The fear is that this mini senior review may do an end run around that process where, you know, the APAC and the public may not have a say in what happens there. So that is, you know, that is what's going on, unfortunately. And so before that review happens, there needs to be some clarification as far as what involvement the APAC is going to have. Now we get over to the state of the Deep Space Network and deep space communications in general. That was also on the minds of many during the meeting. There are currently high demands on the network's bandwidth for science data, and that demand is increasing, while the capacity of the network, unfortunately, is not. Demands on the network just remain high and will even get higher once the Artemis program starts rolling up. And, I mean, you've got the CLIPS missions and so on and so forth. So that demand for bandwidth is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, one of the problems is you don't want any data loss, and that is the main concern, because you're going ahead and spending all this money to get these devices out there, these telescopes, these rovers on Mars, these, you know, Earth science programs and so on and so forth, these CLIP missions, and yes, these Artemis missions, and you don't want to lose any of the data from that, including a human mission. That's not a good. And that's been really, really main concern. Now, the Science Mission Directorate NAC member Jamie Foster had asked Nikki Fox during the meeting about the status on the DSN, and Fox indicated that they have a new lead over at SCAN. That is Kevin Coggins, who has some interesting ideas and kind of looks at challenges as opportunities. In some cases, they want to go ahead and plug the holes into the network and try to see what they can do to do that. Coggins may be looking at augmenting the system with some commercial solutions. Fox indicated that she's probably going to have a better report on what's going on with the Deep Space Network next time around. She's going to have a nice little sit down with Coggins to go ahead and determine what the game plan is. One of the other members, Sarah Tucker, observed that there'll be an increased demand on the communications network due to many of the CubeSats that the heliophysics department will be employing. And she's wondering about the impact the DSN, those CubeSats are going to have on the DSN. And that's unknown right now. So that's something that they have to go ahead and take a look at. And again, Kelly Holly Brockelman was also worried that any solution may not be enough or may be too little too late, and wondered, you know, if we have to yell at Congress here. And Nikki Fox indicated that, you know, she's right to be concerned. She's saying that we have all these great missions coming up. We want to make sure that they are all able to send back all of the data they gather. She mentioned too, the upcoming NISAR and Nancy Grace Roman telescopes, the data stream on that is going to be staggering. So you want to go and try to fix that before, you know, these missions fly. A final concern was about the NASA Advisory Council process itself. And this was just stirring. And in a lot of minds, this was really, really the main point, and this was a huge concern. Now, the concern was just getting recommendations to the NASA administrator and to the associate administrator for science, Nikki Fox, and to the deputy administrator, Pam Milroy. That just isn't happening quickly enough. Getting all of the recommendations that these committees find, they just feel that there have been some significant bottlenecks in getting recommendations and observations up to the ninth floor at NASA headquarters so that they can be addressed up there. Now,
am I reading this right, that the full NASA advisory committee hasn't met in a year?
That's what I'm getting to. Lisa Goodwin, one of the members of the SMD NAC, put up a mission chart and said there are about 140 missions either flying or in development. Is there any way that we can move faster on the NAC to support all of this? And the way the process is supposed to work, each subcommittee meets and they get, you know, sit down, do a state of the state, see what each one of these committees are doing, you know, seeing what the astrophysics committee is up to, seeing what the planetary committee is up to. Heck, it works even on the human side, the human exploration side, to see what's going on there, what recommendations need to be forwarded to the NASA administrator. All of this gets fed up to the primary NASA Advisory Council. Now, that Advisory Council, for, you know, a plethora of reasons, according to Nathan Bull, who is the designated federal officer for the NAC SMD committee, indicated that the full NAC Advisory Council hasn't met in a year for a plethora of reasons. And the Science Mission Directorate Committee wants to make sure that the current NASA AA is aware of these concerns a lot faster. So, you know, Nikki Fox can get the information from these advisory committees so she can act on it. However, you know, she can get the pulse of the committee, but she can't actually act on any of these concerns until they're approved by the full NASA Advisory Council, which, as you just mentioned, hasn't met in a year. So what's going on with the NASA Advisory Council system? Is the NAC system kind of falling apart? And that's a huge question.
I mean, it's getting overloaded.
Yeah, well, it's not overloaded. I know General Lester Lyles, who is in charge of the NAC currently, I know the past year or the past about 2 years ago, he was having some medical challenges, and the beginning of last year, they finally met and, you know, sort of sorted all this stuff out. Now, I don't know if those medical challenges are continuing or not, and it's not for me to speculate on that. I don't know what the reasons are that the NASA Advisory Council has not met, but I hope people understand that the NASA Advisory Council does play a role and tries to go ahead and make recommendations to make the agency better so it can accomplish its mission. And if we can't get to that, and if we can't get to this point, and if people aren't getting the data that they need to act on, then there's a problem. There's a bottleneck, and something needs to be addressed.
Wow. It's a serious problem, and it sounds like there has to be some more work on some solutions.
Yeah, we're going to be watching this, and because I have a tendency to be a fly on the wall in a lot of these NAC meetings, and I'll have to, and I'm not just talking about the overall NAC, I have a tendency to be a fly on the wall in a lot of these other subcommittee meetings, because they are open to the public, and anybody can really go ahead and take a look at them. All you got to do is look at the Federal Register and see when they're meeting. A lot of these are virtual to the public. And yes, they're, and I keep saying this to a lot of people, including the armchair astronauts that are out there, and you know who you are on social media, that think that they can do better. There is always a public comment section on these things. And, you know, for those of you who think you've got ideas, go ahead and attend one of these things and make a public comment, you know, and either, you know, speak now or forever hold your peace.
So Gene, we wanted to briefly mention what's going on with ULA's Delta IV Heavy, the final launch.
Yeah, the 16th and final launch of the United Launch Alliance Delta IV Heavy was set for this past Thursday afternoon, March 28th, with, I believe, liftoff was somewhere around 2:45 planned. The liftoff, of course, was to be from Launch Complex 37 at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. The payload was a satellite for the National Reconnaissance Office, designated NROL-70. Because it's a NRO payload, again, we don't know what it is. I'm sure it's a spy satellite of some sort, but it also will have other duties as well, and that is taking care of the country during times of emergency and times of need. Now, we got up to we got out of the planned 4-minute hold. It was released right after the last go, no-go poll. We were well into that, into the last 4 minutes of the countdown when all of a sudden an abort call was made. As ULA's CEO, Tory Bruno, put it, quote, we exceeded the limit for wins and had to call a hold within the 4-minute recycle. And during that hold, a gaseous nitrogen pipeline pump failed, causing the scrub. The hope was to go ahead and recycle for Good Friday. They thought they got the pump fixed earlier in the day, but it looked like it didn't work out all that well later on during the day, and they had to basically scrub. The next launch attempt is, well, TBD. So we'll just have to watch for that and see what happens.
So, listeners, we wanted to bring you a little bit of an update on what's going on with Forespace, the company that coordinated the materials, design, construction, and placement of the first fine art exhibit on the moon, which was Jeff Koons' Moon Phases project aboard the recent Intuitive Machines IM-1 lunar lander expedition that landed on the moon last February 22nd. And that's Chantel Beyer. So, thanks for being with us, Chantel.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back. You know, it was such an exciting time. And, you know, since the landing, what a thrill. You know, we were on the edge of our seat the entire time.
I know I was, literally. Yeah, well, we followed the Four Space story, your story, from the beginning of the IM-1 mission and wanted to get you on the show one more time to talk as much or as little as you want to about Jeff Koons' Moon Phases art project that was mounted to the side of the Odysseus lander, which was nicknamed Odie. And as we all eventually learned following the landing, Odie did not land optimally. He had twice as fast a descent rate as was planned and had an unprogrammed forward momentum as well that ended up causing at least one landing leg to break and buckle, resulting in a 30-degree tilt to the lander, with the Moon Phases exhibit unfortunately facing down toward the lunar surface, as mm-hmm. we understand it. And then following Odie's planned shutdown in the face of lunar nighttime, it was hoped that Odie would reawaken after sunlight started hitting its solar panels again, even though it wasn't designed to survive that lunar night. And lunar day arrived again on March 20th, and hopes were that the IM-1 lander Odysseus might beat the odds and respond. But Trent Martin, who's a senior vice president of space systems at the company, had said earlier that week that, quote, "I think it's highly unlikely that it will call home again, but there is a possibility, and we will listen for the next couple of days." And however, Intuitive Machines X account reported that as of March 23rd, 2024, at 10:30 a.m. Central Time, flight controllers decided that their projections were correct and Odie's power system wouldn't provide the power to complete another call home. And so with all of this, you know, learning all of that must have had an effect on you after all that hard work to get to the moon. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about that? How was that for you?
Sure. So you know what? It was really sad that Odie didn't wake up again. But you know what? We had expected that too. And you know what? We look at this mission as a huge success for us. Surviving the trip to the moon, the isotropic radiation, and landing. You know, I'll tell you a really interesting story. When we were looking at the lunar lander and deciding where to place the artwork on the lunar lander, we were thinking of two different locations. One, do we place it on the foot of the lunar lander, or do we place it on the side of the lunar lander? We ended up choosing the side of the lunar lander so that we could get the images that you see everywhere, right? We knew that it was very important to get those images of the artwork with the Earth in the background and the moon in the background and as it's landing. And if we had placed it on the foot, we were worried about the lunar plume. We were worried about too much dust and possibly harming the cube even more. And so when Odie tipped over, it actually allowed us to get closer to the moon than planned. So we were really happy because our image, the very last image that we received, we're actually very close to the moon. So that made us happy because we had to choose between, you know, the side of the lunar lander or you know, on the foot, which would have placed us right on the moon. So saying that, Jeff Koons was also super happy as well. You know, it kind of was the universe bringing this whole project together in a beautiful ending for us, because that photo was worth everything to this project to really show how culture and humanity's just bridges and now connects to the moon. So from that perspective, we're happy. And, you know, we've now got Jeff Koons, who is incredibly ecstatic to have his artwork placed on the moon forever. And our mission was supposed to last forever, you know, with the artists saying, you know, we've got space tourism coming up. We've got astronauts heading to the moon. We have the Dear Moon project that's heading there. Can they photograph our work when they're touring around the moon? You know, that's important to us. So our standard actually was more than the NASA standard, which was the 14-day mission, right? One lunar day. Right. So we were actually challenged with a greater challenge with Jeff Koons. So all of our materials testing, we had to make sure that we would survive kind of forever, as long as possible.
That's excellent. And I didn't know that little detail about trying to decide between mounting on the foot and mounting on the side panel. And, you know, that even makes it more special in terms of the knowledge that the most important thing is that it got there, and it got there intact, and it got there first, and it'll be there forever, or at least as long as we can predict. Mm-hmm. During our lifetimes anyway.
Chantel, can you share anything that you've maybe heard from Jeff Koons about, post-landing? And I know there were three components to his artwork.
Yeah, so we have now updated our website and it's www.jeffkoonsmoonphases, and it shows the three components very nicely. It shows our cube, it shows the 125 historical figures, and it shows a beautiful rendering of each one. And so you can go through and see each one. And then it also talks about the 15-inch statue that remains on Earth. And he goes through the whole story. So they've did a wonderful job on building out the website. And, we worked really hard on that. And Jeff worked very hard on that. So he's now so happy. And he sent me a personal message and just couldn't be more thankful for having this opportunity. You know, in his whole life, I don't think he imagined that he would ever actually have artwork on the moon. So that was wonderful. And, we're now getting ready to do our marketing, of the project, and we've got our Pace Gallery as the gallery that's exhibiting and marketing, all and displaying. We're going to put all of our moons on display and for everybody to come in and see. You know, it's been 3 years of working on these beautiful, beautiful sculptures, and that Jeff has placed a diamond on the South Pole where we've landed. And so it's really, really cool to see this spectacular artwork that, you know, you connect to the moon now and you just kind of are embraced by this beautiful project.
I know that the last time that we spoke on the show, which was, I believe, right before the landing on the moon, you said that you might have some interesting information to share in the near future about ForeSpace's next project. Anything you'd like to share with us now?
So I can share details that we have our second mission coming up, but I won't be able to announce what the exact project is for quite some time. We're under strict NDAs, but I can tell you that it is super exciting, and it plays off of the artwork that we've sent, and we're continuing in that area of just really expanding imagination and culture, and this time kind of we're reaching the luxury market as well. So we're really excited about this project.
So, I mean, you're heading back to another heavenly body?
Yes, indeed. You bet.
Well, thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us. We really appreciate it. Anything else you wanted to talk about that we haven't discussed so far?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we are getting ready to do. So we've got our second mission that we're planning. We also are planning to attend the International Space Development Conference in May, which is going to be in Los Angeles. And that's with the National Space Society folks. And another thing that we did was we gave a talk at USC to the Space Architecture Group. And it was a beautiful conversation where we really kind of expanded their imagination and showed them, you know, how we can start bridging the gap between, you know, art and engineering, and how you can position things in a different way. I think it kind of blew their minds when we showed them all of the testing that we've done. I kind of gave them an inside look into all the thermovac chambers and stuff that, and all the materials that we had to test before we knew we could, you know, we had 24 karat gold, we had different adhesives that have never been used before. And we had to space verify everything. So kind of to show them that as they're thinking about the future of space, here's some things that we learned from our project and things that we're really going to have to research more because it just doesn't exist. You know, NASA has a really nice guideline of different inks and different materials, but it's just a guideline. There are still so many more materials that we need to test. And that was a wonderful conversation. And I had some wonderful questions. And some of the questions were actually even geared towards financing. You know, how did we finance a project like this? And that was a wonderful question because when you're not going after a government grant and you're using private funds, what are the pros and what are the cons? You know, the pro, definitely in this case, we were able to raise the capital very fast, get this mission, and do all of our project in such a short time frame and way under a budget that a typical NASA project would cost. You know, so I think that that was just a wonderful experience. And the ROI on the project as well. We will now be able to fund different space projects. We'll be able to fund different education sponsorships. We've already funded Doctors Without Borders and AMFAR. And, you know, so there's this duality of, you know, the importance of the scientific research. But we also have to show the finance world and the business world and the future, even kids and everybody, that this is now a real industry and we have a business structure where we can make money. It's a $1 trillion industry. And if you have any skill set at all, we can bridge that into the space industry now. So it was really wonderful to see these students thinking about that and asking the questions, you know, how did you get the funding? How did you get this all together? And you know, that's one of the keys to the success of this project was being able to do that and in the short time frame that we were able to do. That's where we are today. And, you know, every time we just had a full moon a few days ago, and I just sit under that full moon and I just can't believe that we have accomplished going back to the moon after 50 years.
Never think about it the same way again, will you?
Yep.
So that's a true marriage of art and science and finance and engineering. Just like the real world. So that was a really good example for those kids.
Thank you.
Well, again, thank you very much. We really appreciate your time. Mark, any last thoughts from you?
No, I just want to mention to remind people to take a look at 4space.co, number 4, space.co. Such a pretty website.
Thank you.
I know we talked about it before you had it live, and mm-hmm. when I first saw it, blew my socks off, and I shouldn't be surprised coming from you. So thank you very much.
Another marriage of art and technology, right?
You bet.
Thank you very much again. Take care.
Thank you.
So that was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with Chantel and Gene. Something else you wanted to mention?
Yeah, first, it's good to hear that Chantel is going to be over at the ISDC. I know she's a director over at National Space Society, and I'm glad she's going to be over at ISDC talking about this mission and giving it a little bit more press and giving it a little bit more exposure. It's good to hear, too, that she's got another mission in the hopper. Unfortunately, she can't say anything about that yet, and I totally understand. Hopefully, she'll come back to talk to us when the time is right, and I'm looking forward to hear what she's got up her sleeve. Real quick, JAXA's SLIM mission. Now, we would be kind of remiss if we didn't mention that SLIM did awaken after its two-week lunar night and has sent back a new image of its surroundings on the Sea of Nectar and the lunar surface. Again, it gets awfully cold. I mean, we're talking about minus 170 degrees centigrade during the lunar night. So, or Celsius, excuse me, I'm old school. So, bravo to JAXA. Glad they got this, they got their mission up and going. But we kind of knew Odie was not going to wake up. I believe everybody, when we talked to Tim Crane, he also kind of indicated that he did not expect Odie to wake up after that lunar night. So well done to IM-1. We're back on the moon. And looking forward to the next CLIPS mission that Intuitive Machines has got planned, and looking forward to the launch of the Griffin lander with Viper coming up. Once Astrobotic gets its act together and understands fully what happened to Peregrine 1, they'll get Viper going on their Griffin lander, and I'm looking forward to
so much to keep track of, isn't there? It's getting to be pretty crazy.
Oh boy. Yeah, Mark, remember when they said, well, what are you going to talk about after shuttle? Oh boy, if they only knew.
So before we go, Mark, you have anything you wanted to add to all that?
No.
Very well. Then I will just mention that our listeners, you now have a way to easily ask a question or let us know what you're thinking by sending us a voice recording that we can use on the show. And you can do that by just clicking on the blue microphone icon at the bottom right of any page on TalkingSpaceOnline.com. And this is Larry Herron calling it a night for another episode of Talking Space. Thanks to my cohorts, Gene McCulka.
Thanks, Larry, and we will see you all next time. And yeah, please make a comment, guys. I'm waiting for it because I check my mail every time, because those comments go into my mailbox, and I kind of look for those. So if you really do want to make a comment, and you know, keep it clean, because if you're poking a stick in our cage, we'll go ahead and run it. So. Again, looking forward to hearing from y'all. And if you don't want to leave a comment, that's fine. You can always run us by at mailbag@talkingspaceonline.com. That email address still works.
And also say good evening to Mark Ratterman.
See you later.
Well, on that note, I'm Larry Herron, and this is Talking Space, and we will see you next time. Take care.